you so much for joining us today. We're so excited to have you here.
Likewise. Thanks for the invite.
So we thought maybe we could start with just, you know, hearing your background, what got you into focusing more on pregnancy-related everything. And yeah, just tell us your story.
Sure. Yeah, I actually ended up in the prenatal space a little bit by accident. I thought when I went into the nutrition field, I'd focus on childhood nutrition. And then some opportunities came my way in the gestational diabetes space. And there I learned how big of an impact a mom's metabolism and blood sugar has on her baby's metabolism and health. And it was like, you know, the light bulb moment where I was like, okay, we can actually address the childhood issues in part by helping moms have healthier pregnancies. So yeah, that's kind of how I got into prenatal, and just kind of expanded from there. I mean, I did a lot of work in the gestational diabetes field on the policy level with the state of California, also in clinical practice as well. And it was there that I started, you know, realizing that a lot of our guidelines were not really well designed for managing blood sugar in pregnancy. And that kind of spiraled into all the direction that my work has gone over the years, which is really looking very specifically at, like, how did our guidelines come about? What was the evidence used to set them? Is there better evidence out there? Essentially, can we do better to support women? So yeah, that's ultimately landed with me where I have, you know, three books all going into different facets of women's health. I have Real Food for Gestational Diabetes. That was the first one. Then Real Food for Pregnancy, and now Real Food for Fertility as well. So I think people kind of know my work as kind of questioning the guidelines and trying to look more deeply at whether research supports them or not, and how can we optimize.
That's amazing. So when did you realize okay, I need to start writing books about this stuff because it's getting out of hand? I can't even imagine you, someone who is so educated on this. Like, I even cringe when I hear people say oh, I just eat whatever in pregnancy. It doesn't matter. Like, eat whatever your cravings are. So I can't even imagine how you feel when you are writing these books and have these evidence-based practices, and then you hear people talk like that. But yeah, when was the deciding point where you were like, we have to do something about this?
So the tipping point came after I'd been working in a perinatology office. I ran their whole gestational diabetes program. And, you know, we had incorporated sort of this, what I call my real food approach for managing gestational diabetes, and had just amazing outcomes, like way lower chances that a woman would ever require insulin or medication. That rate was down by over 50%. It was very rare that they'd develop other complications that are common, like preeclampsia or preterm birth, having a larger than average baby. I mean, their babies were healthier. Their postpartum recovery was healthier. Like, everything was just better. And yet that approach to this day is still really controversial. And so it was after I had moved on from that clinic, and I already had been, you know, writing my blog and my website, and just hearing from people continuously, not only women with gestational diabetes, but also other practitioners about, okay, I implemented these guidelines and my client's blood sugar is getting worse, or my blood sugar is getting worse, but I don't know what to do. Like, they tell me I can't make any further nutritional tweaks. I just have to go on insulin or medication. And that kind of gets you on a cascade for a really over-medicalized pregnancy and birth. And that just broke my heart. I was like, no, nobody's writing about this. First of all, nobody has the balls to question the guidelines in pregnancy, because nobody wants to touch that with a 10-foot pole, right? It's like, you don't want to do anything that could potentially harm mothers or babies. And so nobody wants to question those guidelines. I'm like, I'm actually a person who has the evidence to back up what I'm saying. And I think the best way to get this across is in writing. Like, I couldn't be a keyboard warrior. At the time, this was Facebook groups were a thing. I couldn't keyboard warrior in all the Facebook groups about, you know, you can actually do this different and maybe have a much better outcome. I was like, I need to write this down somewhere, honestly. So that's what got me to write Real Food for Gestational Diabetes. That came out in 2015. So I started writing that in 2014. The other books have all kind of come by demand from the audience, right? So I'd get questions about prenatal nutrition. You know, the gestational diabetes book is very hyper-focused on blood sugar management in pregnancy, right? We're not going into all the weeds of do you actually need to avoid this very long list of foods in pregnancy? I'm not going into all the various lab tests in pregnancy. I really am like keeping it very hyper-focused on blood sugar. And so naturally people are like, well, what about all these other things that might be questionable in pregnancy? Can you go into that? Do you have a resource on prenatal nutrition in general? And, you know, I scoured the market for all the books that were out and it was all like rehashing the same really garbage information, just super outdated information. I was like, okay, maybe I need to do this. At this point, I had gone through my first pregnancy and I was really disappointed by the absolute lack of information on anything that you can do preventatively or to optimize your outcomes. It feels very much like when you're pregnant, your provider is just like looking for problems instead of like proactively trying to help you prevent those problems. I was like, this is messed up. Okay. I do think this is enough information to write another book on. I really don't like to just like put out repetitive information. I find that boring. So I was like, I'm not going to write another book unless it's necessary. And it did ultimately feel necessary. So they've kind of all like built upon another. I get enough questions about a topic that it's like, okay, is this enough for a full standalone resource? And, you know, likewise for the fertility one, it is, because people are like, well, what about PCOS? Well, what about hypothalamic amenorrhea? Well, what about sperm quality and egg quality and ovarian aging? And it's like, that's its own can of worms too, you know? So yeah, they've all kind of come organically after that first one.
Did you get some pushback from colleagues or people in the birth world when you wrote Real Food for Gestational Diabetes? Was there like controversy around your book?
I mean, of course, there's always controversy. You can't put out anything in this world without getting pushback. I will say, I think I've gotten a lot less pushback than I expected, probably because the way that I present the information, I'm pretty anal about citing everything. And so while yes, this is like my professional opinion of like all of this data, I'm also citing the research studies that I use to form my stance. So it's less like, this is my opinion, just do this. I mean, the health and nutrition space is full of so many wild opinions and not all of it actually has research to back it up. So I'm very careful in what I write about to make sure that it is something where we actually have research supporting it. And if it is something where we don't have research, but it's something that I've found to work clinically, I'm very clear about that as I'm writing about it. So yeah, I think I've had a bit less than I expected, but certainly I was super scared to put out that first book. I thought I was just going to be absolutely eviscerated by my colleagues. Most of them have actually been pretty supportive.
What about like your friends and family? Were you nervous about them? Were they like, oh my gosh, what is she doing? Or was everyone supportive?
I mean, for the most part, that was a non-issue. I mean, I come from a pretty health conscious family. Mm-hmm. That said, I do have friends and family members who to this day are vegetarian or vegan. And so I do support an omnivorous diet. And that was definitely something that early on in my work, I shied away from writing about it. And you'll see that progression if you happen to pick up my books. And Real Food for Gestational Diabetes, yes, there's animal foods incorporated throughout the meal plans and I'm recommending them, but I just don't even address the vegetarian topic. Cause at the time I'm like, why even open that can of worms? And second of all, it is really not the best approach for managing blood sugar. I've worked with many, many vegetarians who are vegetarian for all sorts of different reasons. And they are by far the most challenging cases for keeping blood sugar in check. I mean, I know all the tricks. I've been vegetarian before myself, so I know how to do it. It's really freaking hard and the outcomes are not nearly as good. So I just kind of left it out of the gestational diabetes book. And then in Real Food for Pregnancy, there's like a small section on vegetarian diets and the challenges and tips to optimize, like snuck in the end of a chapter. And then by the time Real Food for Fertility came out, I mean, there's a whole chapter on it. And I mean, ultimately, like there's certain topics where with those friends or family members, I'm not going to sit around and tell them that they're wrong all day or like preach to them about how they should change their diet. That's their personal choice. So I take a very like, here's the evidence, do what you will with it. And if you're not interested in looking into it, I'm not going to bombard people with that information. But if you pick up my books, it's going to be in there, presented in a really like non-emotional, just data-driven kind of a way. And, you know, people can do with that what they want.
So how important is protein for blood sugar? We talk about that all the time on this podcast, eating protein in, you know, pregnancy and pre-pregnancy, but how important is it in blood sugar overall?
It's huge. It's huge. I mean, it's a huge missing factor that a lot of people are not considering. And I've kind of shifted my approach to this over the years as well. Like I used to lead in really heavy with, we need to pay attention to carbohydrate quantity and quality and really switch, get people away from the ultra processed foods and refined sugars. And I'm still in agreement with that. But the way in which I get to that is by encouraging people to eat more of the things that don't raise their blood sugar, protein being one of the key ones. So it's kind of, yeah, it's subtly a bit different these days. Because what I find is when you just lead with avoid all these things, people don't know what to eat,
mm-hmm.
or they just end up under eating and starving all the time. And they need to know what you're eating in place of the processed foods. It's like everybody knows the processed foods and excess sugar isn't good for them. It's not rocket science. But a lot of people are really afraid about consuming more protein because they've heard all this information about meat or animal foods or saturated fat or cholesterol, any of which are going to steer them away from consuming those foods, right? So you kind of have to like tackle that head on for them to be open to eating more of those things. But yeah, it's absolutely crucial. If you're not getting enough protein, it's really challenging to keep your blood sugar in check, not just the spikes, but also preventing the lows. I can say this as somebody who had reactive hypoglycemia for many years when I was unknowingly under consuming protein and over consuming carbohydrates. I was like the person who had to travel with like emergency snacks in my purse, you know, like eating every couple hours. It's like exhausting to stay on top of preventing low blood sugar, right? So it can go either direction where people are spiking their blood sugar really high or bottoming out too often. And protein tends to be a really helpful tool for addressing both of those issues.
For sure. And I think back to when I was pregnant with my son, I just didn't know anything really. And I just remember like no mainstream OBs or even like mainstream midwives are really talking to moms about like, you know, you go into your OB appointment, you're pregnant, maybe it's your first time, you're so excited, but like they're not sitting you down and being like, okay, what you're eating is directly affecting your baby, your blood sugar, your outcomes in pregnancy. It's just crazy that we have to outsource this information in order for us to like thrive. And I think a lot of people think pregnancy is miserable and they don't feel good. And it's just like people could probably feel so much better, but the information is just not readily available. You're not going into the OB office and getting a pamphlet that is talking about blood sugar regulation and how important protein and fats are and the outcomes of your baby. I remember reading in your book about the importance of healthy fats and like, you know, avocado and whole dairy. And it's just crazy because I was telling my friend about it and she was like, I'm not kidding. I think that's why my son was 4 pounds when he was born. I didn't know I should be eating a bunch of healthy fats and proteins. And it's just crazy that even though logically it makes sense, right? We need to be eating healthy fats and proteins and all the things, but a lot of people just don't think about it because we're never taught this. We're never even taught about healthy fats in like high school, in college for nutrition classes. It's just crazy that we can't just have this information readily available. So it's so amazing that we have people like you who are willing to take the time to, you know, write this out for us. But even still, it's just kind of luck of the draw of who can come across this information or who doesn't. And that directly plays an outcome in their pregnancy and their children's health.
Yeah, it's really shocking when you look at, you know, how much education a typical doctor of any kind has about nutrition, but including OBGYNs. I had a post on my Instagram sometime last year that was about a study looking at OBGYN residents and how much education they had. And it was like the average OB gets maybe 1 to 2 hours of nutrition education on prenatal nutrition. And then, you know, I was thinking about that and I was like, okay, well, how much education did I even get on, like, right? I did 5 years in nutrition. Like, I did a full, you know, bachelor's degree. I did a whole year-long clinical internship. And yes, it was at a really big hospital in LA that had everything. And we had a maternity ward. And, you know, I'm like, okay, but how much did I actually get on prenatal? And I was thinking back, I was like, okay, I think I had a couple lectures as part of a course in my undergrad. And then I had maybe a week in the maternity ward at the hospital, and that's it. And I surveyed other dietitians in my sphere. I'm like, was this everyone's experience or was that just me? And it was pretty consistent, like 80, 90% got just a lecture or two. There were some programs where there was an optional class where you could have like a 3-credit class on prenatal or women's health nutrition. That was pretty rare, like a, you know, couple percent got that. And many recalled like zero information on pregnancy nutrition. So it, a lot of it really is not out there for the general public. And even healthcare providers, even those who specialize in nutrition, it's just like, it's hard to find. And then what you do find just rehashes the guidelines because you look at the pregnancy guidelines as a whole. They're really kind of an offshoot of the general dietary guidelines for Americans, which those are kind of a train wreck. You know, those came out in the 80s. They've been slowly revised, but very minor revisions over the years. For the most part, they're still encouraging like a high carb, moderately low protein, low fat diet. And they're still having restrictions on things like saturated fat and sodium, even though there's research questioning whether that's actually necessary. And you start to kind of like dig into, okay, well, let's look at these different micronutrients and why they're important to fetal development. Where do you find them in foods? Oh, they're in these foods that are high in saturated fat that you just told everybody to avoid. Or the food safety issues, right? There's all these like supposed rules about foods you need to avoid for food safety reasons in pregnancy. And that's another area where it's like, are those things actually justified based on the rates of infection from consuming those foods? And then what are the nutritional trade-offs if you aren't consuming these foods anymore? Like recommendations on fish, for example, it's very, you'll get a wide range of recommendations if you ask different clinicians on whether you should include fish in pregnancy or not. Some of that's a food safety concern. Some of that's, you know, a potential mercury or contamination concern. But nonetheless, it's like, there's very little consistency. So it is, like you're saying, kind of luck of the draw. Like, what does your provider know? How much additional education have they sought out on their own on those topics?
Okay, my next question for you is, if there are new moms or newly pregnant women on here listening to this right now, or they're thinking of becoming pregnant, can you just give a few tips of, like, I guess their best bet for getting off on the right foot with pregnancy and their nutrition?
Yeah, great question. And my answer would probably depend on how far along are they, mm-hmm. because it's a little tricky to talk about optimal nourishment in pregnancy when somebody is pretty new, like, mm-hmm. like 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 weeks. Because a lot of times you're going to have nausea and food mm-hmm. aversions come up during that time. And that makes it really tricky, right? Like, it's kind of a survival mode situation. So I will assume we're talking about somebody who's beyond mm-hmm. the, you know, aversions and nausea phase. And if you want me to come back to that, I'd be happy to. But thinking about like how nutritional requirements change, especially later on in pregnancy, certainly your body needs more food, and you will know that by your hunger cues. I really highly encourage mindful eating for honoring those signals that your body is sending you. I think a lot of women, well, it really depends. There's, you know, people experience pregnancy in different ways, but I think a lot of women kind of question if they can really trust their body. Mm-hmm. So many of us have been bombarded with diet culture and restrictive eating for so many years that sometimes people feel a bit scared that their hunger has increased and like, should I actually listen to this? And I don't want to gain too much weight. And you need to honor that hunger. And if you're feeling like that hunger is like out of control, like you eat something and you're hungry right away afterwards, first of all, always honor the hunger and eat. But second of all, check in with yourself and see if you're actually getting enough protein. Because if you're not getting enough protein, and that should be protein-rich foods where you haven't taken all the fat out of it, by the way. So like whole milk yogurt and you know, nuts, eggs with the yolks, chicken with the skin. Don't take all the fat off of your steak. Like, eat the fat that comes with the protein. It's there for a reason. But if you're not getting enough protein, oftentimes that'll lead to the crazy cravings and hunger that will follow you around for the rest of the day and maybe even the rest of the pregnancy. So really check in with those cues, check in with how much protein you're eating. You are definitely going to need an increase in the amount of protein you're consuming, especially as your pregnancy progresses. Another thing I would just say is really try to maximize the nutritional value of every bite of food that you can. So say you're craving, I don't know, sour gummy worms or something. It's like, how could you get that satisfaction, like that flavor or texture that you're seeking without having the high fructose corn syrup and red dye number 40 and all that other stuff? I mean, maybe there's a time and a place in Nauseaville where you just need to have the sour gummy worm. I get it. But like, could dried tart cherries, maybe with, you know, salted cashews paired with them for a little better, you know, macronutrient balance, could that kind of get you that sweet, tart, chewy flavor with all the good nutrients that are also in the cherries, right? Like, are there ways that you can maximize things? Yeah, those would be some of the top tips, really prioritizing protein, mindful eating, and just look for all the little ways that you can optimize.
Mm-hmm. What about, I had a question come in. She was asking, she's on a tight budget and obviously wants to eat really healthy in pregnancy. What would you recommend for people on a tight budget? How can they optimize their nutrition?
Yeah, I have a whole article on my website on this for anybody who wants to look it up. It's called something like budget-friendly prenatal nutrition. If you just search budget at lilynicholsrdn.com, you'll pull up the article because there's a much more detailed answer than we probably have time for here. I would first start, you know, sometimes our protein-rich foods are a really significant portion of the food budget. So I would look where you can choose, you know, cheaper cuts of meat, for example. So instead of steaks, go for ground beef. Instead of boneless, skinless chicken breast, you could do a whole chicken or chicken drumsticks or bone-in chicken thighs. Once you make those, you can save all the extra bits like the bones and stuff and make broth that gives you essentially like a free meal out of it. I would maybe not be quite so picky about food quality. You know, like I could talk about food quality all day. It's wonderful if that's available within your budget. But if that's not, choosing the non-organic, non-grass-fed pasture-raised options is perfectly fine. Like conventionally raised single ingredient whole foods are still going to be better than probably even the ultra processed organic snacks at your grocery store, right? So just try to shop the single ingredient foods regardless of how it was grown or raised is sometimes a necessity. You can swap in things like beans in place of some of your protein. I wouldn't have it replace all of it, but that's a really low cost, still pretty high nutrient density. It doesn't have all the same nutrients and the same amino acids as animal foods, but it's still perfectly fine to replace a portion of your protein intake with beans. And you could do those, you know, beans or lentils that you buy dried and cook like in your slow cooker, for example, that cuts way down on cost. Looking for things like frozen vegetables instead of fresh, or if you're in an area that has, you know, farmers markets and things available, sometimes you can get a deal on those or use, you know, those various nutrition assistance programs that sometimes will give you vouchers or coupons or things to use at those local markets for vegetables. So you can get creative about it, but it is tricky. I would also just add, you know, ultra processed foods, regardless of the quality, are really expensive for what you're actually getting out of it. Like a box of cereal is really expensive. Like, so as much as you can, looking for the single ingredient options, it may take more time at home, but almost everything becomes a trade-off of time or money, right? Mm-hmm. Like the pre-made meals in the freezer section may seem like a great time saver. However, you're getting very little food for that money in the grand scheme of things. So buying in larger quantities, buying when things are on sale, cooking in bulk, utilizing your freezer, those would all be ways to cut way down on the grocery bill.
Yeah, those are really good tips. So would you say that when people have like these crazy pregnancy cravings, do you think that's mainly just due to them being deficient in essential micronutrients? Like when people are saying, you know, I'm craving P pizzas and burgers and even like the weird things. Like some people, you know, say they crave the smell of paint or bleach or all of these things. Do you think this is more correlated to the lack of micronutrients people are getting because they just don't know better?
Sometimes it can be. Cravings for ice, for example, are pretty strongly correlated with iron deficiency anemia. Cravings for things like chalk or like eating drywall and stuff is strongly correlated with either iron or calcium deficiencies. So mineral deficiencies do kind of line up, especially for the cravings for non-food items. Mm-hmm. Those are obviously of a concern because you may be consuming all sorts of random contaminants. Like we don't really, drywall is not really food grade, right? So that can be a component. There can be certainly people who want like more burgers. I hear from a lot of former vegetarians, like, oh, all I wanted was like a burger, a steak, certainly can be a sign of a need for more essential amino acids, protein, iron, zinc, vitamin B12. Like sometimes your body will guide you to the things that you actually need. Sometimes it's simply a sign of blood sugar imbalances. If your blood sugar is going spiking high and dipping really low, that naturally drives cravings. So if there's a lot of blood sugar instability and usually insufficient protein intake, you'll see cravings for a wide range of things potentially. And then sometimes there's the emotional component. Maybe there's like nostalgia to the mac and cheese that your mom made when you were little. And so I see a lot of people kind of driven to things that were comfort foods from their past during pregnancy, which may have nothing to do with a deficiency in anything or a blood sugar imbalance. It's simply like that is comforting to them and their body is seeking that feeling of safety and comfort. So I really encourage people to, you know, kind of get curious about what might be driving the cravings. It's, you know, not wrong to potentially give in to those cravings. Certainly we can try to like choose better quality things and obviously safe actual food to, you know, satisfy the cravings. Somebody who's craving chalk or something, I'd probably be encouraging them to seek out high calcium foods, for example. But yeah, just get curious about like, could there be an underlying factor that's driving this?
That's so interesting. On the flip side, what about aversions? Like I'm used to eating 150 grams of protein a day, but when I was first pregnant, my first probably till like 16 weeks, I had the craziest protein aversion. I mean, I didn't want anything to do with it. I've heard theories maybe it's like a safety mechanism to avoid like raw or parasites or like undercooked things. But what's your theory on that?
Yeah, I think there's something to that because a lot of times the aversions are to protein-rich foods, and especially if they're raw. Like some women can eat meat or fish, but not if they're the ones who have to cook it. Like they can't handle the raw protein. It's just like, and yeah. I cannot handle the raw chicken. You cook it outside on the grill and like cut it up for me and bring it in on a plate and then I can eat it. But like touching it just makes you completely averse. In that instance, I think there could be something to, these are typically a high risk for, you know, foodborne illness or infection. And, you know, if you were living in sort of a tribal community, you couldn't like store raw meat for long periods of time. It spoils really quickly. So it'd have to be like harvested and cooked or prepared right away before you consume it. So I think that there's something to that. I've also found that individuals who come into pregnancy pretty well nourished, like you've been eating an omnivorous high nutrient density diet for a while, I find they're more likely to be kind of averse to the high protein foods early on. Like maybe your body has enough. Mm. On the flip side, I've heard from some vegans, for example. I remember I did an interview with one woman who was telling me about she had been vegan. And then pretty much right away when she got pregnant, she started craving like burgers, like eggs with the yolks and oysters. Mm. It was like this unexplainable craving. And you talk to a typical omnivore, somebody who's been eating high protein previously, and those are often things they'll be averse to. So maybe her body was kind of driving her to it again for a nutritional need. The other category of foods that are often pretty averse are vegetables. And I think there's a component to that of, you know, if you think back over the history of humankind, we didn't start, like all the vegetables we have on the market for the most part are hybridized. Like we have specifically selected certain traits in foods and then bred those over the years. This is separate from like genetically modified stuff. You can like selectively breed plants to produce leaves that are less bitter, fruit that is larger and sweeter and has fewer seeds. And we have done that for, you know, hundreds of years at least. And so when you look back over the history of human nature, where we were just foraging what's out in the wild, you go and forage some wild greens, they're extremely bitter. And they might have compounds in them that could potentially be teratogenic, things that cause birth defects, right? And so maybe this aversion to vegetables has something related to that. It's hard to say, but I think that's one of the theories that's out there.
That's super interesting. That was me to a T. I'd have to go to my friend's house and my husband would have to grill on their grill outside and bring it back into me. And that was how I got protein. I didn't eat any vegetables. It was just fruit. I wanted fruit and I wanted sourdough and butter. That was like all I wanted in my first
And a
few
lot
weeks.
Of times these symptoms are overlapping with nausea. So the food aversion, the height of food aversions is usually at the height of nausea. And with nausea, your body just wants things that are easy to digest. Mm-hmm. You know, the longer something sits in your stomach, the more likely it feels like it needs to come back up. And so carbs digest really quickly, leave your stomach pretty quickly. They kind of quell that. It's a bit of a double-edged sword because if you go pretty much eliminate protein, like I'm averse to that, I'm not going to eat it at all and only live off carbs, then you end up with this blood sugar roller coaster. And then the blood sugar roller coaster can actually trigger worsening nausea. So it's a bit frustrating to be in it. And I mean, you know, I had some nausea both in my pregnancies as well. And it's like a struggle. It's like you have to force a little bit of protein in there so you're not going hypoglycemic. The hypoglycemia triggers a histamine response, and then the histamine response worsens the nausea. And it's like you have to find a way to get off of that cycle. But sometimes the only way is to like get an in with some type of easily digested carbs to like take the edge off the nausea and then find some type of protein that you can tolerate, whether that's the meat somebody cooked in another house and brought back in or some nuts or some peanut butter, cottage cheese, Greek yogurt, egg salad, I don't know, whatever it is for you personally at this time. And that does often help, but it's a bit counterintuitive. It's tricky, you know?
Can you give an example? Let's say someone's in the first trimester, they're nauseous, they're like, I cannot stomach any protein. What is like the next best thing? Is it going to be like a healthy fat for them to eat, like, you know, a cheese or raw cheese? Or what is their next best option if they are like, I cannot eat a protein in this period?
Yeah, I mean, whatever you can keep down, honestly, make the best choice that you can. So if the only thing that sounds good is bread and butter, make it like the best quality sourdough you can get or whatever bread you could tolerate, really. But, you know, high quality ingredients if you can, and like a lot of butter. So you're getting some blood sugar stabilization there. Mm-hmm. In an ideal world, again, after you get a few bites down, you're feeling a little more settled. Maybe you can test the waters with a couple bites of something that's high protein. I mentioned cashews and dried cherries. That was actually like a really good combo for me personally during some of the height of nausea. So I would do that. I'm getting the sweet and tart of the dried cherries, but I'm getting like the protein and fat and saltiness of cashews. And that sometimes sat really well. I find that a lot of women do well with beans, interestingly, in the first trimester. They, you know, they don't have quite as much of a smell as some of the other proteins. You're getting some carbs in there. They're, I don't know, Mexican food is sometimes kind of comforting. They're high protein, they're high folate, they're high potassium, usually adding a lot of salt to them. So you're getting like a good electrolyte balance with them as well. And sometimes electrolyte imbalances can make the nausea worse. So if beans or lentils or Mexican food works for you, go that route. Dairy is often a lot easier tolerated than some of your other animal proteins. So if that works for you, Greek yogurt with some fruit, like put all the things on it that make it yummy to you. Like maybe you need some granola on there. Great, go for it. As long as you're also getting that protein in from the Greek yogurt. And honestly, it's like, I wish I could give you, you know, if you always do this, like the nausea goes away, but it's so different for every person. And I don't know if you two felt this way, but for me, it was very like touch and go. It was like, okay, this is working for me in this hour. And like, Next hour, the thought of Greek yogurt is completely revolting. This smells like rotten milk. I never want to see Greek yogurt again. And then the next day, it might be different. So you just have to make the next best choice with what your body is willing to accept. And again, it's usually for the vast majority of women, it is a phase and you outgrow it and you can get back to eating more normally later on in your pregnancy, but just do the best that you can.
We're just trying to survive.
Just seriously.
Okay, I wanted to go back to GD for a minute. I know it's kind of on the rise and I was just wondering, do you think it's maybe misdiagnosed, overdiagnosed? Is the testing flawed? Is there environmental factors or is just our lifestyle? Like, what do you think is causing this rise in GD?
Yeah, there's a number of factors. So, you know, first of all, population-wide, we have increasing rates of diabetes and prediabetes. And essentially what you're seeing with gestational diabetes is precisely that. It's insulin resistance or carbohydrate intolerance in pregnancy. And it's not like we're doing a great job of keeping on top of, you know, annual physicals with everybody and screening everybody's blood sugar all the time. So a lot of women are coming in to pregnancy not knowing that there's an existing blood sugar or insulin regulation issue. And we have universal screening in pregnancy now in the U.S. anyways. So pretty much almost everybody, unless you find a way to opt out, is getting tested. So we're just catching more of it. And a lot of that could have been pre-existing. Because if you screen in the first trimester, for example, with like a hemoglobin A1C, which looks at your average blood sugar over the past few months, that's really looking at pre-pregnancy blood sugar regulation. And women who fall into the pre-diabetic range, their chances of failing the later glucose tolerance test is upwards of 94 to 99%.
Wow.
So, you know, a lot of times there's a pre-existing issue. That said, with the testing, it's very complicated, the gestational diabetes diagnosis standards, because there are several different methods and thresholds that can be used for diagnosis. Even when you're looking at the so-called gold standard of a glucose tolerance test, there's multiple different versions and guidelines out there. If your provider happens to be following one of the more stringent diagnostic criteria, you have a greater chance of getting diagnosed, but your case may be really mild. So we are also catching milder cases of gestational diabetes than before. This is, in my opinion, generally of benefit in the grand scheme of things, because those more stringent criteria were developed because we were seeing that the adverse effects on the baby start at much lower elevations in blood sugar than were previously thought when they set up the other guidelines that are a bit more outdated. That said, the way that the medical establishment manages gestational diabetes, sometimes they're really over-medicalizing and fear-mongering and also not giving great guidance necessarily on keeping blood sugar levels in check. So say you get you get diagnosed, but it's a mild case. And then you go and meet with a dietitian and she's giving you a meal plan that's a minimum of 175 grams of carbs per day. And maybe for you, that's a lot more than you normally consume. So it's like, okay, we've identified there's an issue with how many carbohydrates your body can tolerate in one sitting. Now you've been given a meal plan that's more carbs than you were eating before. And guess what happens? Your blood sugar runs super high. They need to start you on insulin and medication. Your birth and postpartum can often become more medicalized. Like, it can be kind of a mess. So assuming you're getting good information, go buy real food for gestational diabetes instead, or take my gestational diabetes course. I think the milder cases, there's often, it can be, you know, a blessing in disguise, a much healthier pregnancy, weight gain is a bit more in check, baby's growth is appropriate, and a significantly lower risk of various complications. So it all depends on how it's managed.
That's so interesting. Do you think sperm health has anything to do with the outcomes of gestational diabetes or anything, or placenta health maybe?
There's some information on gestational diabetes related to sperm quality, but more of the stronger research is on placental development and on preeclampsia risk, actually. So yeah, it's pretty interesting when you look at it. So the placenta is formed from embryonic tissue ultimately. So it has the genetics of both mom and dad, but it more strongly expresses dad's DNA. which is super interesting. Yeah. So the placenta really does, it has a strong relationship to male sperm quality, which is why, you know, they observed over the years that, like, there were some women who seemed to get, it's like, say you have a woman who's had preeclampsia and three pregnancies in a row, and she separates from that partner and has a new partner, and then she doesn't have preeclampsia in that fourth pregnancy, which is completely defies all odds, right? Because usually if you have a pregnancy complication, you are at a higher risk for it later on. Then they look, that, you know, first partner of hers, they look at that guy. He's like now partnered up with another woman. She had, you know, two healthy pregnancies before. Then she has a pregnancy with this guy, preeclampsia. It's like, what the heck?
Wow.
Sperm quality. It definitely plays a role. So that the healthier your partner is, the greater chance that everything will go smoothly in your pregnancy. Also, if you develop a complication, you can blame him and get mad at him. But, you know, it's also related to the mom as well, because it's not just, you know, the placental development, but how well it embeds into the uterine wall. And that has something to do with your endometrial health, ultimately, which is really the health of your hormones and your menstrual cycle in advance of conception. So it's all interrelated. But this is an area where I think we're getting an increasing amount of research. It's just so common that any pregnancy issue or fertility issue gets blamed on the woman. And now we have a lot more research coming out looking at what is the male factor component here. And in some of that data, it's pretty significant.
Does the same go for, I've heard, like, for heartburn, like moms with heartburn in pregnancy, and same with morning sickness, nausea, is that the same, or can it be from the sperm?
I have not seen research on that specifically, whether it's linked to sperm quality or not. There's all sorts of, like, old wives' tales on on your likelihood to have heartburn, or, you know, if it's a boy or a girl, or whether it predicts whether your baby is going to have a lot of hair or be born practically bald. And yeah, I don't know if any of those actually hold true.
Okay.
What are your thoughts on the, like, just managing blood sugars at home rather than, you know, doing the diagnostic tests? I know you said that maybe the more, like, strict tests are kind of better in a way, but what about doing it at home? What are your thoughts on that?
I mean, I'm in favor of that if your provider's on board and if you're, you know, if you're going to actually do it right. Like, you need the right match of, like, provider and pregnant woman. And I say this as somebody, I did home monitoring in my second pregnancy instead of doing a glucose tolerance test. I've written about this on my blog. In my first pregnancy, I failed the 50 gram screening test. And they want you to do the 100-gram test. This, by the way, that's the outdated oral glucose tolerance test thing that's still used in most of America. But the rest of the world and California and some other, you know, areas that are a bit more progressive on their diagnostic criteria, they just do a single-step 75-gram glucose tolerance test. If that had been available to me, I probably would have done that. But nonetheless, after that experience, I was like, I'm just going to monitor this at home. And at the time, I was able to have access to a CGM, a continuous glucose monitor. So that's what I did my second pregnancy, also cross-checking with, you know, a finger stick. I think the reason that people don't want to do this, or clinicians are kind of hesitant to agree to that, is A, it's not in the guidelines, right? The guidelines are glucose tolerance test. Even if there's all sorts of variation in the way in which you do the glucose tolerance test and the diagnostic criteria and the thresholds, nonetheless, the standard of care is a glucose tolerance test. So they kind of, like, I think they feel like they have a liability if you skip the test and don't get diagnosed. Like, some of them will treat you as if you have gestational diabetes if you don't do the screening test, or they won't keep you as a patient, right, if you don't want to do it. The challenge is, like, if you do home monitoring, again, which I'm generally in support of as an alternative, obviously I did it for myself, is that clinicians don't know how to interpret the data. Like, with a screening test, you just have, like, whatever criteria you're using in that office, that's the criteria. You either pass or fail. Your blood sugar is either higher than the threshold or it's within range. Like, they get a yes or no answer that, like, they can check the box off on your chart. Whereas if you have somebody monitoring at home, it's like, okay, well, how many readings are we going to count as a positive diagnosis? What threshold are we going to use? Are we going to go by like glucose tolerance test criteria? Are we going to go by gestational diabetes criteria? Are we going to go by the data we have on what average normal healthy pregnant women have for their blood sugar readings? And that is gray area. And that's something that a lot of clinicians just don't want to deal with. So I think that's why there's pushback. But out of all of the other potential alternatives to a glucose tolerance test, I prefer people do an at-home monitoring for a week or two. I prefer that they're testing some of those meals as high-carb meals, because we do want to see, like, what is the threshold at which your blood sugar starts coming out too high, essentially. And those will give you a lot more information than just doing something like a test meal, like one meal, you know? Okay, just do this one meal and we'll test your blood sugar once. That's like one data point. It's kind of useless. It's going to be so impacted by the macronutrient composition. It's just not giving you enough information to really truly screen out blood sugar issues or not. The jelly bean test or eating candy, those have other issues. Drinking juice, that has other issues. You got fructose and glucose, not just pure glucose. So it's like, if you're going to forego a pure glucose tolerance test, or even if you do like the fresh test, same thing. If you're going to forego a glucose only screening, I think your best option is to do a series of blood sugar checks over a period of time, so you're getting more than one data point, because so much can affect our blood sugar readings.
I think that's really helpful
information. I know it can be super overwhelming, and a lot of women just don't know they have other options too. They just, you know, just do exactly what the doctor says, and then that's that. So
yeah, and I do, by the way, have a section in chapter 9 of Real Food for Pregnancy going through the different alternatives to the glucose tolerance test, the pros and cons of all of them. So if people want to dive into that, you have charts of, like, you know, gestational diabetes cutoffs and normal healthy blood sugar levels in pregnancy. So if you are doing home monitoring, you have something to compare it to. That's all covered there if you want, you know, more detailed discussion on this. But you do have options. And again, it's my opinion that I think providers should be offering options, because there are also potential cons and of a glucose tolerance test. And sometimes you can get false positives or false negatives. So you should be offering options, in my opinion.
Or at least informed. Yeah. Informed consent.
Yeah. Yeah.
And everything. Well, thank you so much for coming on. I am a huge fan of yours. I'm a doula too. So I always have recommended your books for years to everybody. And this has been a real treat to have you on, and so informative. And I know this people will take a lot away from this episode.
Oh, thank you for having me. It was fun.
Can you tell people where they can find you? Are you on Facebook, Instagram, where they can buy your books, all of that?
Sure. Yeah, I'm on pretty much all the, well, not all the social media platforms, because I'm now like an elder millennial, but I'm on the platforms. I'm on, you know, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, now X, whatever it's called. I'm not on TikTok. I'm most active these days on Instagram. So if you want to do a social media follow, that's where I'd go. And my handle is Lily Nichols RDN. My website also, lilynicholsrdn.com. That's kind of like my main hub of information. So I have hundreds, literally hundreds of free articles. There's no paywall on my site. So click the blog tab, search the blog tab for whatever keyword topic you're interested in. There's very likely an article on the topic. That links out to my books as well. There's a tab on my website for books. Click on that. You'll see where you can buy any of those. I have all sorts of freebies available. Click the freebies tab. You can get, you know, the first chapter of Real Food for Pregnancy for free. Or I have a free video series on gestational diabetes. There's all sorts of goodies there that are free for the taking. And then for practitioners, I have, you know, additional training if you're interested in specializing in prenatal nutrition. I run a mentorship program through the Institute for Prenatal Nutrition. So there's lots and lots of options up there. So do spend a bit of time on my site and pick and choose.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thank you.
Bye. That's it for today's episode of Moms Unbothered. If this conversation made you think differently, question the norm, or even just feel a little more empowered in your health journey, do us a favor. Share this with another mom who needs to hear it.
If you're loving the show, the best way to support us is by leaving a quick review, subscribing, and connecting with us on social media. It helps us reach more moms who are ready to take back control of what goes on, in, and around their families. We'll be back next week with another conversation, but until then, trust your instincts, question to everything, and stay unbothered.